All right, so can everyone hear me okay? Okay, let's begin with the quiz that I just left over here. This is why I need an assistant, you see? He gets paid very well, I can tell you. He does it for free. Okay, so number one, a collection of properties that can all be had by the same individual at the same time or all together refers to what? Is it A, omnipotence, B, necessity, C, compossibility, or D, monopoly? We used to play Monopoly. Sometimes if you had all the properties, you're doing good. It's actually C, compossibility. Compossibility is something where you can hold two things or more, two or more things, and it's not absurd. So compossibility. We say that God has the greatest array of compossible grape-making properties. So now if you can't hear me back there, just have me direct myself toward the mic a bit more. Number two, which best describes the ontological argument? A, if it's even possible that God exists, God exists. B, existence is contingent. C, there are worlds in which God does not exist. Or D, God's existence requires faith.
A.
It's A. The ontological argument makes the case that if it's even possible that God exists, then God exists necessarily, because why? He's a necessary being. Now, if you haven't, we're in here for the last class, that may seem like, oh boy, that can't make sense at all. It does. You'll have to review last class. The thing is, now, that puts the onus on the atheist. The atheist has to show why it's impossible for God to exist. Because if it's possible that God exists, God exists. Number three, perfect being theology contends, A, God is a maximally great being. B, God is morally perfect. C, God is that thing none greater can be conceived. And D, God is necessary. It's all of them, yeah. It's all of them. Letter C is a little funny sounding, but it isn't a typo. This is the way that Anselm constructed it. He didn't even want to say that being. He wanted to say, God is that then greater. He just said then. He didn't want to put in the word being. Number four, which helps us provide a maximal description of reality? A, ultimate meaning, value, and purpose. B, possible world semantics. C, the epistemological argument, or D, warrant? It's actually B. Yeah. So when we talk about possible worlds, what we're trying to give is a maximal description of reality. Like, you know, in every possible case we're trying to look at. So that one's, those, it's called possible world semantics. Now, by the way, if some of you feel like you're being robbed, push back a little bit and maybe I'll give you credit, but it should be B. Number five, that something cannot be true and false in the same sense at the same time refers to what? A, God's aseity. B, contingency. C, proper basicality. Or D, the law of non-contradiction.
D.
Yeah, the law of non-contradiction simply is something can't be true and false in the same sense at the same time. That is the most basic law of inference. And to try to argue against it is just to prove it. So you will, it's self-defeating to fight it. God's aseity just means his self-existence. Contingency, we'll talk about proper basicality. We've mentioned in the past. Number six, which of the following are compossible properties? A, being being married and a bachelor. B, being omniscient and good. C, being all-powerful and necessary. D, being round and a triangle. It's B and C. This is what compossibility is. Remember, compossible properties are something that can be had at the same time. Otherwise, the A and D are impossible. Number seven, I think this is the trickiest one out of them. Which of the following could possibly exist? A unicorn, B, a leprechaun, C, a one-ended stick, or D, a talking donkey?
A, B, and D.
Now, here's why. It sounds kind of crazy, but what we're trying to get at here is that we don't think that they actually exist, necessarily. But when we talk about possible worlds, maybe in some possible world you could have a little elf-like creature, or maybe a horse-like creature with a horn on its head. It's not an absurd kind of thing. It's possible, even though it doesn't exist. But it's not impossible. But what is impossible? A one-ended stick. Because a stick, by definition, has two ends. You know, it becomes absurd. So that one was kind of tricky. I don't know how we did on that one, but... Anselm refers to A, a monk, B, a means of necessity, C, a proponent of the ontological argument, or D, a kind of calculus.
A and C.
Anselm was a monk about in the 1000s, 1079, 1078. And he was a proponent. He is one of these people, he had one of the earliest versions of the ontological argument. He's the one that said, God is that, then none greater can be conceived. He is the greatest conceivable being. Which best describes contingency? A, an intrinsic property of God. B, something that could fail to exist. C, it derives its existence from something else. Or D, an emergency backup plan.
B and C.
Yeah, it's B and C. Although some of you might think it's an emergency backup plan. Sometimes you have to have a contingent plan, but it's not. In the context of our discussion, contingency, something that's contingent, it derives its existence from something else. And because of that, it could fail to exist. You know, if your parents hadn't met, you could have failed to have existed, you know. Number 10, to defeat the ontological argument, one must A, demonstrate that unicorns might exist, B, argue for a maximally great pizza, C, demonstrate the concept of God is incoherent, or D, argue all things are contingent. It is actually C. You have to show, the atheist has to prove that even the concept of God is incoherent. Because if it's even possible that God exists, God exists. The others, you know, well, unicorns might exist in some possible world, I don't know. But thing is, it has nothing to do with God's existence or the ontological argument. Or a maximally great pizza, well, pizzas are carbohydrates, fats, and proteins that gets eaten. You could always have more pepperoni or less. I mean, it could fail to exist.
But they can also argue that someone created God.
Well, we'll talk about that today. But how, you know, what we say about God is he's maximally great. So if some God was created, he would be a contingent being and not a necessary being, and so he wouldn't be God, right? So by the very definition of God excludes it. So they can make the argument, but here's the thing. Everybody has to assume a first cause. Otherwise, you get an infinite regress and no explanation, right?
Now, question number 10, why D is not, part of the answer?
Well, that's a good question. I thought somebody might say that. If you said everything is contingent, if you could demonstrate everything is contingent, you might be able to defeat the ontological argument because it says that there is a necessary being. But it's hard to imagine what a world would be like if everything were contingent. All it would mean is there's an infinite series of regression. So, you know, A explains B, explains C, explains D, and so on, except there is no A. There's no starting point. It just, everything goes back. So you're saying, well, the explanation for your existence are your parents, and then their parents, and then their parents, and then, and it just keeps going back, but you never get an end. It's almost like having an infinite number of books, and each book before explains the book after, except there's no book end. So what I mean by that is everything is contingent. You're saying everything derived its existence from something else. But what is that ultimate something else? So I see where you're coming from, though. If you could demonstrate that, I just can't imagine what that would look like. I haven't seen a successful argument that everything is contingent. Because what that would mean is nothing is necessary. And if nothing is necessary, it's hard to see where you get a first start. Or it seems to me like a triangle necessarily has three sides. So I don't think that's a contingent feature. Yeah.
Could there be an infinite future? If there's an infinite future...
You know what? Hold that question, because we're going to talk about whether there can actually be an infinite number of things.
Just trying to reconcile the logic, though. It's even possible that God exists, that argument.
Yeah.
Like in number 7, you said a unicorn up from talking about you could possibly exist.
Uh-huh.
So can you argue that unicorns exist? you argue that, then doesn't that kind of make the argument about God existing?
That's a great question, actually. So the question is something like this. Well, couldn't you just argue that a unicorn possibly exists, so therefore it exists, and then apply that principle to God? What would be the difference, do you think? Well, we don't. But it seems to me that unicorns are possible. I don't think they exist. But what it is that, were you here for the previous class?
No.
Oh, if you weren't here for the previous class, it's probably very confusing. What we argued was this, that, and we'll talk about it because we're about to flip the page for the bonus. But what we said is this. And actually, let me walk you through it, flip the page over. Now, what we were saying was there are two kinds of being. We said there's necessary being and contingent being. And we asked the question, which would be greater to have? Now, what is contingent being? Just means you derive your existence from something else or you could fail to exist. But necessary being could not fail to exist. So if you were a maximally perfect or great being, you would which would be better to hold? Necessary being or contingent being? Would it be better to exist contingently or necessarily? Now, you might say, well, does anything exist necessarily? I think we can make the case that we did last week, so you'll have to look at that video. But now let's suppose God is a perfect being, and this is what the church has always said. If God's a perfect being, then he possesses the property of necessity, that characteristic of necessity. Now, we're not going to say God exists, but let's go through this argument on the back. This is Alvin Plantinga's version of the ontological argument. He just makes a very modest claim. He says, it is possible that a maximally great being exists. Now, another way you might say that is, it's possible that a necessary being exists. He's just saying it's possible. He doesn't even say it is. And then he says, number two, if it is possible that a maximally great or necessary being exists, then a maximally great being exists in some possible world. So we'll say it exists in some possible world. But here's the thing. If a maximally great being exists in some possible world, it exists in all possible worlds, or in every possible world. Now, why is that? Why wouldn't it just exist in some possible world?
Because it's maximally
being. Well, it has the property of necessity. If it were a contingent being, then it might exist in one world or not another, or many worlds but not another. But if it has the property of necessity, it has to exist in every possible world. Number four, if a maximally great being exists in every possible world, then it exists in the actual world. Because remember, the actual world is just a subset of all the possible worlds. And number five, if a maximally great being exists in the actual world, then a maximally great being exists, because we live in the actual world. Therefore, a maximally great being exists. The idea turns on this idea of perfection. We said God had all these things. He's omniscient, omnipotent, omnibeneficent. You could list a whole other things, but we said one of the properties God possesses is necessity. And if something's necessary, it could not fail to exist in any possible world. So if it's even possible that God exists, God exists. Now, does this prove God exists? Well, actually, an atheist could say, no, actually, God couldn't possess the property of necessity, but then they'd have to demonstrate that. Or God isn't perfect, or maybe the concept of God is like a married bachelor. You can't be all-powerful and all-good at the same time. That could be a defeater, but I've never seen a successful version of that argument. How did we do on the quiz? Anybody got them all right? Anybody? How many got... I only missed one. Okay. All right. Two? Okay, and three. All right. Questions? Yeah, it is possible. Oh, you mean on the front side or the back side? Front side is compossibility. And this is what an atheist might argue against the ontological argument. They might say all these great making properties aren't compossible. You couldn't hold them together. And that could be a problem. But there are ways around that. So... overall, did pretty good. Now, why are we doing this class again? One of the things I said was apologetics strengthens the faith of the believer and aids in fortifying your faith. Sometimes you may come across things that make you doubt. So in January, I actually took a doctoral apologetics class at Denver Seminary with Doug Groteis. Now, Doug Groteis, if you look in your syllabus, he's one of the writers in the book is about this thick. It's on apologetics. Now, Doug, his wife recently passed away, that is last year, but before she passed away, she had developed a kind of dementia. It's a special kind of dementia, very rare. And his wife actually was a member of Mensa. She was a brilliant writer, great with words. I mean, she's a genius. I mean, to get into Mensa, I think 140 has to be your minimum IQ. Brilliant. Doug is brilliant, too. But as she developed this horrible disease, he is caring for her. Now, it's horrible enough for her, right? It's horrendous. This is what you'd call a horrendous evil, it would almost feel like. One of many things that she's known for is her mind, but it's going away. And it's a kind of dementia that takes place very slowly. And she wasn't old. I mean, this is not something really late in life. And he's caring for her, and it gets to the point where caring for her is a real hard thing. It's not easy because she can't remember simple things. And you get to a point where you just can't in any way remember anything. The brain just declines. So here he is, a famous Christian apologist. And he went through a very dark time. He wrote a book called Walking Through Twilight, where he just kind of recounts this. It's just a horrendous thing. And he said, you know what? My faith was really challenged. And he said, for all those people who don't think apologetics is helpful, he said, it helped save my faith in a way. Because when you see someone you love declining in such a way and you're caring for them and they're just slipping away, every day is a new torture. It almost seems as if you have to hold on and you wonder, is God good? If God's all powerful, and people were praying, all these kinds of things. This is the problem of evil, which we'll talk about later. But Doug credits, in part, apologetics. He said, I was a professor of apologetics. I am a professor. He was teaching my class. And I want to say that this isn't all just, esoteric nonsense that you're doing. It actually has real life significance. You may encounter a dark night of the soul at some point in the future. It might be the case that you're wondering where God is. And you don't feel him like you used to feel him. And you might have to be able to reason your way. You know, the mind may have to help you a bit. Sometimes it's the supernatural presence of the Holy Spirit. You experience some kind of miracle. And sometimes it's what God has planted here. You know, the noodles between your ears that you can hold on to something. So what I'm saying is that it's not just to shape culture and it's not just to win unbelievers. Apologetics might help you hang on to your faith. Okay? So all that to say, it's important. So let's pray. Father, I thank you so much for this class. I thank you for the students that come out. Lord, I know this is not easy, and it's cold out. Lord, I pray a special blessing on each person. Not the easiest topic, but their willingness to be here is a sign of their commitment in many ways to you and just to the process of learning about you and learning to defend you and to share their faith, God. So I pray that today you help us to learn together, Lord, that you help your people to grasp what you want to teach them, Lord. Help them to pay attention because I know many are tired, God. Many aren't feeling well. I pray for healing, Lord. Restoration, God, where someone is sick, make them whole. Lord, I pray that you anoint this class, Lord, and use it for your glory in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, now, by the way this class works, you can at any time raise your hand. A lot of times I'll stop and say questions, comments, or concerns, and you just tell me what you're thinking. And it's okay to push back, because I don't want, some of this stuff would be like, I don't know if I buy that. Well, then ask a question and push back, and if you're not satisfied with my answer, push back again. And by the way, I'm going to push back. Now, that's not a sign of being a jerk or argumentative. What it is to help develop the skill, and it actually shows that I respect you. If I push back, then that means that, I'm not going to be a jerk about it, but I might say, no, I don't think that's right. And you might say, well, no, I don't think that's right. And that's fine, but we're going to learn together. So what I'm saying is you have freedom to push back. Okay, so today we start the cosmological argument, and we're going to look at two versions of this. But before we get into it, anybody know this passage? It's familiar, right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things, how many things? All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. Now, this frames kind of the argument we're going to talk about, but I want you to notice that up to this point, and we really, once in a while I'll point to Scripture, but none of these arguments require Scripture. Actually, they're entirely apart from the Bible. That doesn't mean that we don't respect and submit to the authority of the Bible. It just means that an atheist may not buy your argument from authority. They'd be like, well, yeah, well, that book of fairy tales. Then you have to give them something else. So all that to say, we want to be biblically based, but we're also, the art of apologetics is to build bridges, and sometimes you don't get the Bible as a plank in the bridge. So you have to use something else. Does that make sense? All right. So there's a guy, anybody ever heard of Leibniz? Yeah, so Leibniz, brilliant guy. Some people argue he's the smartest guy that ever lived. So they estimated his IQ is too far back, somewhere between 160 and 200. Who knows? I don't know how you even measure something like that. But he was involved with philosophy, theology, and mathematics. Do you know, and you, all you people who've taken calculus, you can thank him and Sir Isaac Newton, who independently, at the same time, invented calculus. He is a bright guy. I mean, I don't know who just comes up, by the way, let me just invent calculus, one day. It's just, that's something. So integral calculus, differential calculus, and the like, you can thank him. And tons of other philosophical insights. So he had this great idea. I don't know if anyone's ever thought of it. Why is there something rather than nothing? We talked about this a little bit last week, and the reason why I put the hardest argument, which was last week, up front, was because it's going to relate to this argument. Leibniz was looking for an explanation, not a cause. This is important. He's looking for an explanation for the universe's existence, not a cause. And he uses something called the principle of sufficient reason. Now, we'll abbreviate this sometimes. We'll say PSR because I just don't want to say principle of sufficient reason. But what is that? Well, what that means is there must be a reason or rational explanation for the existence of one state of affairs rather than another. In other words, for anything, it seems right to ask for an explanation. So a principle of sufficient reason is going to try to give us a sufficient explanation for something. So there are two kinds of cosmological arguments tonight we're going to look at. One is from contingency. It derives its existence from something else. And one is a temporal version. So we talked about contingency versus necessity. What I want to ask is that unclear to people right now? Anybody have a problem with the concepts of contingency and necessity? Because Leibniz is going to argue that the world is a collection of contingent things. The world is a collection of contingent things. So it's important that we know the difference. This first argument by Leibniz is closely related to the ontological argument from last week. So argument from contingency is interested in an explanation for the world or the universe or the cosmos. The argument from temporality, we're going to talk about a little bit later, is interested in the cause of the cosmos' beginning. I think the one from temporality is going to make the most sense to you. You're going to be like, oh, wow, this is actually an interesting argument. I think they're all interesting, so I don't know where you're coming from, but I like them all. So questions, comments, or concerns right now before we launch? No? All right. This is the basics. Notice this, the argument from contingency, this is the first one we're looking at. All it's interested in is an explanation for the cosmos. The argument from temporality, interested in the cause of the cosmos' beginning. And if I have your email addresses and your information, I can send you a link to all these slides. But this is important. Two arguments, and this is what they're interested in. We don't want to confuse them. All right, for all those visual people, Patience, if you can cut the light right there. The other one can stay on, I think it's fine.
We live in an amazing universe. Have you ever wondered why it exists? Why does anything at all exist? Gottfried Leibniz wrote, "The first question which should rightly be asked is, why is there something rather than nothing?" He came to the conclusion that the explanation is found in God. But is this reasonable? Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence. If the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. The universe exists. From these, it follows logically that the explanation of the universe's existence is God. The logic of this argument is airtight. If the three premises are true, the conclusion is unavoidable. But are they more plausibly true than false? The third premise is undeniable for anyone seeking truth. But what about the first premise? Why not say, the universe is just there, and that's all. No explanation needed. End of discussion. Well, imagine you and a friend are hiking in the woods and come across a shiny sphere lying on the ground. You would, naturally, wonder how it came to be there. And you'd think it odd if your friend said, there's no reason or explanation for it. Stop wondering. It just is. And if the ball were larger, it would still require an explanation. In fact, if the ball were the size of the universe, the change in its size wouldn't remove the need for an explanation. Indeed, curiosity about the existence of the universe seems scientific and intuitive. Someone might say, if everything that exists needs an explanation, what about God? Doesn't he need an explanation? And if God doesn't need an explanation, then why does the universe need an explanation? To address this, Leibniz makes a key distinction between things that exist necessarily and things that exist contingently. Things that exist necessarily exist by necessity of their own nature. It's impossible for them not to exist. Many mathematicians think that abstract objects like numbers and sets exist like this. They're not caused to exist by something else. They just exist by necessity of their own nature. Things that exist contingently are caused to exist by something else. Most of the things we're familiar with exist contingently. They don't have to exist. They only exist because something else caused them to exist. If your parents had never met, you wouldn't exist. There's no reason to think the world around us had to exist. If the universe had developed differently, there might have been no stars or planets. It's logically possible that the whole universe might not have existed. It doesn't exist necessarily. It exists contingently. If the universe might not have existed, why does it exist? The only adequate explanation for the existence of a contingent universe is that its existence rests on a non-contingent being, something that cannot not exist because of the necessity of its own nature. It would exist no matter what. So, everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. But what about our second premise? Is it reasonable to call the explanation of the universe God? Well, what is the universe? It's all of space-time reality, including all matter and energy. It follows that if the universe has a cause of its existence, that cause cannot be part of the universe. It must be non-physical and immaterial, beyond space and time. The list of entities that could possibly fit this description is fairly short, and abstract objects cannot cause anything. Leibniz's contingency argument shows that the explanation for the existence of the universe can be found only in the existence of God. Or, if you prefer not to use the term God, you may simply call him the extremely powerful, uncaused, necessarily existing, non-contingent, non-physical, immaterial, eternal being who created the entire universe and everything in it.
Basha, can you get that light for me? All right. Let's see. Now, did that make sense to people? Do these visual, do the videos help a little bit? I mean, if nothing else, but for the break. I mean, I think it's... So, let's talk about it a little bit, can we? What is Leibniz saying here? Now, we talked about this principle of sufficient reason. And nothing happens without sufficient reason. I think most people find that intuitively true, right? That, you know, there's a reason. For anything that happens, there must be some kind of a reason. Now, notice this. You can have existence through contingency, meaning you derive your existence from something else. We live in a collection of contingent things, the universe. I mean, this music stand could fail to exist. I don't see why it's necessary. I mean, right? The carpet could fail to exist. So many things could fail to exist. But if this whole universe is a collection of contingent things, you can't say everything is a contingent thing, it seems to me. Yet an infinite regress doesn't make sense. If you say everything is contingent, this was your question, you end up defying the principle of sufficient reason, because all you do is keep pushing things back a step. Well, it was what came before, what came before, what came before, and there's never a starting point. That's a problem, because you don't have an ultimate explanation for anything. Now, what about existence through necessity? Now, we said that God had the property of necessity. Well, the reason for the universe's existence must be found outside the universe. If the universe itself doesn't have the property of necessity, then its explanation has to be outside of itself, and must be a thing that it must be caused by a thing, really, that exists necessarily. Now, what that thing is, we'll have to talk about. So here's the argument. It says everything that exists has an explanation of its existence either in the necessity of its own nature or in some external cause. That's what you call contingency. Everything that exists has an explanation, including God. We're not giving him a pass. Now, by the way, this is a softer form of the principle of sufficient reason. It just requires any existing thing to have an explanation for its existence, whether it's necessary or contingent. That's all. So you might say, well, there just is no explanation. But the thing is that it seems to me that explicability should be our default position. We shouldn't. That's just not good science. Oh, you know, we'll just pass the buck. We should investigate things. That should be, when we make a judgment, we should think that things are explicable. So giving the universe a pass, I don't know. I think that's question begging. Why does the universe get a pass? God doesn't get a pass. And then the next step is this. If the universe has an explanation for its existence, that explanation is God. Now, you might say, well, he's jumping ahead too fast. You know, that it seems like that at first. The universe, by definition, by the way, is all physical realities. Everything that you see. The question is it all necessary? Is the universe necessary? I don't think so. But what kinds of things are necessary? I can only think, you know, it might be abstract objects like numbers. Some people argue that. I would say actually one of two things. Either numbers are useful fiction, like Sherlock Holmes might be useful for learning about detectives, but he never existed. So numbers aren't even real. Or you might say that they have always existed in the mind of God, that numbers just are the thoughts of God in some ways. So they actually depend upon God for their existence. But that's the only thing. It seems to me that what would bring the universe into a being has to be something necessary. Okay, if the universe has an explanation for its existence, that explanation is God. Anybody doubt the third premise, the universe exists? I mean, some people do. Can you think of a group, someone who might doubt that the universe exists?
A solipsist,
yeah. Yeah, a solipsist might think that. They might think they're the only thing that exists, that they are the universe. Yeah, good.
Was it already covered in the last lesson that I missed, that if clause of number two?
If the universe has an explanation for its existence, that explanation is God. Yeah, now the reason we say that is this. We're granting that the universe has an explanation for its existence, but could the universe be the explanation for its own existence? Did the universe bring itself into being?
Well, maybe it never had a beginning.
Well, okay, and that's what a lot of people argue. Hold that, we're about to touch on it. But that's a great question. Some people have argued, well, it just always existed. The problem with that, it flies in the face of our modern science and our empirical evidence. And the other thing is that it seems to me that the universe doesn't even have to exist. It seems like it could fail to exist in some way. You know, so if I take any given part of the universe, it could fail to exist. Well, which, if the universe just is a collection of contingent parts, it's hard to imagine how it's necessary. But we're about to hit that. So that's actually a good observation. Number four, therefore the universe has an explanation of its existence, that the explanation of the universe's existence is therefore God. Now, for people who are wanting to take notes or a snap picture, this is the whole argument. Five steps.
Are you going to email us this thing?
I'll email you the link so you can save yourself. So what we're going to do is, remember, a deductive argument, and this is a great, your question is great, because I want you to know that a deductive argument is simply this. If the premises are true, the conclusion follows necessarily and inescapably. That's how a deductive argument works. All men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore Socrates is mortal. If the premises are true, you can't escape the conclusion. But you raised a question about the premises, so we'll talk about that. Let's look at the first premise. Everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature, maybe triangles or numbers or things like that, or in some external cause. I think all of reality could be summed up in that. I think most people agree with that. Do you think? Any pushback on that?
Well, I don't see why number triangles are necessities. This is contingency on somebody throw out some theory. It's derived from somebody's abstract idea.
Well, let's suppose there was nobody in the universe to even think about a number. How many planets would be in the universe? Would there be one or two? Or let's suppose there was nothing in the universe, but there was just the universe. How many universes were there? One. Now, this would be the pushback of a person. I'm with you. I actually think numbers are something like a useful fiction. That they help us, they give us some purchase in explaining things, but they don't really exist. But there are some people, if Platonists, for example, in philosophy, and there are some Platonic Christians, they believe that numbers do exist necessarily. Now, in a case like that, if they deny that it's useful fiction, my pushback would be, well, these have always existed in the mind of God. William Lane Craig has recently written a book on defending God's aseity, meaning his self-existence, and there's no challenge to it. Because numbers, abstract objects presented a challenge, because what we say is, actually, before there was anything, there was God alone. And some people say, well, numbers have always been in the mind of God, and that's why they exist as abstract objects. I think either explanation, useful fiction, or that will work there. But what about, an atheist might say, well, the universe doesn't have a cause. And I'm going to push back and say, oh, yes, the universe does have a cause. And here's why. Do you remember the picture of the translucent ball? Now, part of this is, and by cause, I actually should strike that word. Let's strike that word and say explanation. So my clicker is exactly backwards. If you see me struggling with it, it's because what should turn it one way is the opposite direction. Let's make this word explanation, because the cause part we'll get to later. An atheist might say, well, the universe doesn't need an explanation. Well, if it doesn't need an explanation, then you have to give me a reason why. I'm going to say yes. Do you remember the translucent ball? If we found a ball in the forest, we wouldn't say, oh, it doesn't need an explanation. But if the ball grows larger and larger and larger till it was, coextensive with the universe, it doesn't change the fact that it should have an explanation. Now, you might say the explanation is in its own necessity. Maybe. We'll talk about that. Sometimes this is called, when an atheist says, no, it doesn't need an explanation, this is the taxi cab fallacy. They'll say, well, science and physics explains this. You came from your parents, and they'll trace it back, and the universe came from this, that, and the other thing. But when it gets back to the universe, they'll give the universe a pass. It's like somebody calling a taxi and just sending it away. It's taken me to my destination that the universe exists, and here's how. But it doesn't need an explanation. Well, you can't just give the universe a pass. It has to have an explanation for its existence, too.
And why is that called a taxi cab?
So suppose I want to go somewhere, and I want to go to LaGuardia, and the taxi picks me up. And there's a million, there's maybe the signs along the way explain how I'm getting there. Science gives a lot of explanations for why we exist, and the universe exists, and so on. But once I arrive at the destination, my destination LaGuardia or my destination that the universe exists, then all of a sudden I just tell the taxi, okay, I don't need you anymore, go away. I don't need any more explanation. Well, that's not fair. You can't just dismiss the universe. You can't give the universe a pass and dismiss it like you would a taxi, because it's not like a taxi. You can't just say, bye, taxi. You have to engage the question. Why does the universe exist? What's the explanation? Yep.
I'm kind of jumping back a little bit, but is it possible that, so in the physical world, there are necessary contingents? In other words, things that have to exist in order for something in the physical world. So you can't have this unless that's existed first. You can't make this without that.
Well, let's think about that. Is necessary contingency compossible? What do you think, guys?
No.
If you say something is contingent, but you say it's necessary, the problem is then is it?
Well, I'm saying
it's not contingent.
It's necessary to have a contingent.
Well, all things. Let's just say this: all contingent things, by necessity, have to derive their existence from something else. But you can't go back to an infinite regress. At some point, you have to say something is just necessary in and of itself, its own nature. You see what I'm saying? Unless something is absolutely necessary, it couldn't possibly... if something's contingent, it couldn't possibly be necessary. It would have to derive its existence from something that is necessary. But... if we use our parents as an example, I can't see that any of my ancestors were necessary, even if we went back to protoplasm and something like that. Assuming evolution is true, you just can't escape the fact that you've got to have a bookend at some point. Now, this is maybe getting to your question, unscientific because it undermines modern cosmology. Now, we're going to talk about this more in the next argument, so it's going to make a whole lot of sense. There's a reason why I stacked them together. In short, I'm just going to say this. Our best empirical evidence, our best science, the stuff that we can observe, says actually the universe began to exist a finite time ago. I mean, we have no evidence whatsoever that the universe has always existed. And by the way, it seems to me if you can destroy any part of the universe, it's not necessary. If it could have, I could imagine a quark failing to exist somewhere, or the music stand having never existed, or something like that. So if it can fail to exist, it's not necessary. And by the way, we can skip number four. All I mean by that is, again, the taxicab fallacy. You can't just say the universe doesn't need an explanation. But this word, strike cause and put explanation. Have you ever met anybody who just thinks that maybe the universe is alive, like Gaia or the Force in Star Wars or something like that? Anybody ever heard this? The universe brought us together. The universe told me, the universe There are some people that assign living properties to the universe. Have you ever encountered that?
No, they say, you pray, the universe answers your prayer.
The universe answers your prayer. It's interesting, without any mind. But if the universe is a contingent thing, you run into problems. So let's look at the next premise. If the universe had an explanation for its existence, the explanation is God. If it has one, if the universe contains all physical reality, then the cause of the universe must transcend physical reality. Why is that, do you think?
Well, that's only true if the first premise is true.
That's true. So we'd have to defeat the first premise, partly. Go ahead.
The universe, since we're defining the universe as everything that began to...
We're not there yet. Hold on to your hat.
But the universe can't cause itself.
Well, that's right. So the argument is that it's just always existed. It's a brute fact. She's arguing that it's just a brute fact. There is no explanation. It just always has existed, necessarily. That's right. So the key is here. Look at the subpoint. You're catching on to it. If the universe contains all physical reality, but there was a point where there was no physical reality, no space, time, or matter, and that's the next argument. That's why I want you to kind of hold on. Then you can't say that space, time, and matter brought space, time, and matter into existence, pulled itself up by its own bootstraps, so to speak. You know, because out of nothing, nothing comes. You can't cause something from nothing. Or to cause something, you have to exist first to cause. If the universe caused its own existence, then the universe had to exist to cause its existence. Then you get a very circular argument. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, physicists do talk about that fourth thing
we're going to talk about those in the next argument, okay. But you might be talking about something like the quantum vacuum.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And the quantum vacuum isn't nothing. It's an energy-rich field. But they will say they want to call it nothing. They play this game where there is a guy, Lawrence Krauss, that goes around. He's a scientist, and he claims that that actually the universe is zero, it's nothing, and actually you and I are nothing. So because he says when you do all the physics added up, there's an equilibrium that comes to zero. That's what he says. But that would be like having a check register, buying things and depositing things, debits and credits, all throughout. And let's suppose you, at the end of it, when you balance it, it comes to zero. Well, that doesn't mean there were no debits or no credits. It just means you arrived at zero. But it's kind of a word game they're playing. Literally, when we say nothing, we mean the absence of anything. So we're about to get hit that argument. So hold on, you're actually anticipating. You're ahead in arguments. Yeah. No, these are good questions. This is the questions from a lawyer. So she's a lawyer, by the way. So the atheist might say, "Well, the universe exists necessarily." Theist says, "No, and here's why: none of these things that make up the universe—stars, planets, etc.—exist necessarily." At one point, none of them even existed. This would be the reply. The matter that makes up the universe could have been arranged differently. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way. So the best evidence that we have, and I'm talking about evidence because remember the scientific method is about empirical evidence, it militates against this. Even our modal intuitions seem to tell us that the universe is contingent. I mean, it seems easy to conceive of the non-existence of any and all objects that exist in the world. I want you guys to think right now. Let me give you an example. I can imagine this church not existing here. Just imagine it. But now I want you to imagine a triangle without three sides. Give it a try. Oh. Try it. Can you? You can't. It imposes itself on you in some way. But I could imagine that, you know, I don't know if that helps, but this is what we're getting at. The matter that makes up the universe could have been arranged differently. You know, it seems to me like if there was a quark here, a quark could be over there. Does everybody know what a quark is? I'm talking about the smallest fundamental particle. It doesn't have to be a quark. I just chose that. Many atheists actually agree that it's impossible that nothing exists. That it is, you know, but some claim that contingent things necessarily exist. And this was to your point. They'll say, well, some contingent things exist necessarily. And I'm kind of like, I'm trying to make sense of that. It's like some married people are bachelors. Go ahead.
Is it like, I think one of the contingent things that exists, or I would say this is an example, but it's like the mitochondria in a cell. Like there's some things in a cell that have to exist, both of them have to exist.
Oh, that's called codependence, molecular codependence. That's a different thing. What Anthony's getting at is something like this. You have to have protein to have DNA, but to create protein, you have to have DNA encoded, and the things have to exist simultaneously. It's hard to imagine how they evolve one to the other. In order to make the DNA, or the protein, you have to have DNA, but in order to have, it's kind of like this. I could give you a DVD on how to build a DVD player, but you don't have a DVD player. I give you all the instructions, it's just you can't read the instructions. The two have to exist at the same time to be useful. Now, that is not anything to do with necessity in the ultimate sense. It has it, but that's what we call molecular codependence. Yeah.
That's why I was emphasizing the physical world. In other words, like a piece of paper wouldn't exist without a tree. You know what I mean? That kind of thing, where one thing was needed to have the other thing.
Yeah, it was needed, necessary. But all of those are a collection of contingent things that have to go back to an ultimate thing.
Right.
Now, that is the most abstract one of the cosmological arguments. We're moving out of abstraction from this point on. This is why, Pesha?
So just trying to think about what they were talking about. So, you know, when there were prophecies that Jesus was going to come to the earth, that was necessary, right? Like, that he...
Yeah, well, now what you could argue is this. No, it's contingent. It becomes necessary the moment God decrees it, because now you have a necessary being ensuring that it happens. But if God had chosen not to do that, it would have not been necessary. You see, that I know where you're going with it.
No, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but there is a necessary being that is God, that the moment he decrees something. Now, sometimes he's decreased things to have choices. They may not, you know, if you do this, if you repent, then this will happen. If you don't, this will happen. You know, but then there are some things that it doesn't matter what anybody does. God has decreed it and it's going to happen. So you might assign some, it's not technically necessity in the philosophical sense, but it will surely happen because if God will ensure, the necessary being will ensure that it happens. Okay?
Using the argument that because we can't imagine a two-sided triangle, therefore it has to be necessary because we can't imagine anything other than two sides, I can't imagine myself not existing.
Well, that's right.
Does that make me necessary?
Well, it makes your existence necessary to the belief. Now we're not talking about necessary being. So by the way, when we talk about necessity. Well, there are things like triangles may or may not be, you know, in the abstract sense real. But what you're saying is this. Let me just say this. Humans are contingent. But if you are a bachelor, you are necessarily unmarried, even though you may not exist. So we're not talking about ultimate existence. Your question is something like this. I can't imagine myself not existing. You're exactly right. I think therefore I am. Right, you're going back to Descartes, or maybe even further to Aristotle. Someone has to. You can doubt everything exists. You can't doubt triangles exist that or have three sides because they impose themselves on you. But so long as you are a mind, you could doubt this whole. You might be at home dreaming. We're not even in the classroom. You can doubt everything exists, but you can't doubt your own existence because someone has to be doing the doubting. So, what I'm saying is this. It is necessarily true that you can't doubt your own existence.
Yes.
Okay, but that's the necessity is in the truth, not in your existence. Yeah, yeah. Do you see that? Does that make sense? I mean, if you hadn't been born, trust me, you wouldn't be doubting your own existence or even thinking about it. If that makes sense. Because you could have failed to have been born. But now that you are born, it's a necessary truth that you can't doubt your own existence.
Yeah, that'll take a few hours.
Okay. Well, what I'm saying is that we're talking about the difference between necessary truth and a necessary being. Does that make sense? So one's an epistemological thing, how we know something, and the other is an ontological thing, which is the thing itself. All right. Everything is about to get clear. This argument will make a lot of sense to you guys. And this was a lot of fun because we get to actually play around with a little bit of science. Apatia, cue the lights.
Does God exist? Or is the material universe all that is, or ever was, or ever will be? One approach to answering this question is the cosmological argument. It goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Is the first premise true? Let's consider. Believing that something can pop into existence without a cause is more of a stretch than believing in magic. At least with magic, you've got a hat and a magician. And if something can come into being from nothing, then why don't we see this happening all the time? No, everyday experience and scientific evidence confirm our first premise. If something begins to exist, it must have a cause. But what about our second premise? Did the universe begin, or has it always existed? Atheists have typically said that the universe has been here forever. The universe is just there. And that's all. First, let's consider the second law of thermodynamics. It tells us the universe is slowly running out of usable energy. And that's the point. If the universe had been here forever, it would have run out of usable energy by now. The second law points us to a universe that has a definite beginning. This is further confirmed by a series of remarkable scientific discoveries. In 1915, Albert Einstein presented his general theory of relativity. This allowed us, for the first time, to talk meaningfully about the past history of the universe. Next, Alexander Friedman and Georges Lemaître, each working with Einstein's equations, predicted that the universe is expanding. Then in 1929, Edwin Hubble measured the red shift in light from distant galaxies. This empirical evidence confirmed not only that the universe is expanding, but that it sprang into being from a single point in the finite past. It was a monumental discovery, almost beyond comprehension. However, not everyone is fond of a finite universe, so it wasn't long before alternative models popped into existence. But one by one, these models failed to stand the test of time. More recently, three leading cosmologists, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin, prove that any universe which has on average been expanding throughout its history cannot be eternal in the past, but must have an absolute beginning. This even applies to the multiverse, if there is such a thing. This means that scientists can no longer hide behind a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Any adequate model must have a beginning, just like the standard model. It's quite plausible then that both premises of the argument are true. This means that the conclusion is also true. The universe has a cause. And since the universe can't cause itself, its cause must be beyond the space-time universe. It must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, uncaused, and unimaginably powerful. Much like God. The cosmological argument shows that, in fact, it is quite reasonable to believe that God does exist.
That one make more sense? What do you think, guys? Tell me what you're thinking.
Well, it seems like in order to understand that argument, you have to understand the lab discovery that...
Oh, yeah, that's right. So we need to... Patient, can you flip that light on, please? So you're right. We have to understand some of the physics a little bit. And I think that in apologetics, that's something that we should do. Now, by the way, which is more plausibly true? And really... We're building a cumulative case, and we're trying to tip the scales one way or the other. A person might say, well, I don't know everything. I don't know all these details. And they keep pushing it back. Oh, well, you know, it becomes the science of the gaps rather than the God of the gaps. You just have to keep waiting, you keep waiting, you keep waiting. The problem is that it seems to me that we've got very good evidence. Our best evidence is showing. It's like in the preponderance of evidence in court. Our best evidence right now, our empirical evidence, is actually arguing that the universe began to exist. Let's take a look at this. So the historical background is this. Greek philosophers used to say, well, the universe has always existed. But our modern science, cosmology, astrophysics, and the like, are saying, well, that's not true. It's just not true. Jews actually believed that the universe was created out of nothing, that it derived its existence from God. So this is that important part. Now, there was a Muslim philosopher, Al-Ghazali. It's almost Ghazali, but not, help me.
Ghazali.
Yeah, there you go. He speaks Arabic. So take Tony's word for it. Actually, when I met Tony, it was in Starbucks using this argument. But so he was a 12th century Muslim. Now, he'd been influenced by Christians and Greek metaphysics, actually. But he didn't like the way some of his fellow Muslims were being influenced by Greek metaphysics, even though he himself pulled this argument from some of their logic. And he just basically said it's impossible to have a beginningless universe. It's just impossible. And he gave an argument for it. He said there must be a creator. Now, when you see the therefore, don't take this as an argument. This is not an argument. He's asserting this, and then he gives arguments. By the way, he gives what's called the Kalam cosmological argument. That's the argument we're looking at now. And Kalam just is the Arabic word for medieval theology. So if you ever wonder. So let's look at the argument a little bit at a time. It says, whatever begins to exist has a cause. The key word here is begins. Does everybody agree that whatever begins to exist has a cause? If it begins to exist, that means there was a point it didn't exist. So it has a cause. The universe began to exist. If that's true, the universe has a cause. Now, this is an airtight argument. Deductively, is so long as the premises are true. Now, which premise do you want to challenge? That will be the question.
Number two.
Yeah, the universe began to exist. So let's see what, let's look into that. What do you think? Now, we're going to argue that our best evidence is, remember, I'm not saying that these arguments prove God. I'm saying it makes God more plausible than not. Okay. You understand? Yeah. You see? And we're building a cumulative case. We use the ontological argument. Now we're using two forms of the cosmological argument. To say it's hard to prove anything exists, really, if you think about it. This is that Descartes thing, you know, I think, therefore I am. You can almost doubt anything. The problem is that atheists unfairly raise the bar to the point that they say, unless you can make it indubitable so that I can't doubt it, then I don't believe it. But I'm like, well, you can't even prove other minds exist if you want to go that far, because you might be, solipsism might be true. I might be imagining all of you. I mean, imagine if we raise the bar to indubitability for everything. Nobody's going to get through that except for maybe some triangles and ourselves, right? What I mean is there are very few things impose themselves on you in such a way that you can't doubt them. So we're trying to make the case that belief in God is rational, it's plausible, and it's probable, given the evidence that we have. Now, the case, these are kind of, think about them interlocking pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. We're building a cumulative case here. And I'm going to say that I'm putting something on the table. By the way, this is why this seems so hard at first. This is not negative apologetics where we're just answering, oh, what about bad things happening to good people, where we have to give an answer. We're actually laying something on the table. When someone says, show me, give me evidence that God exists, well, here's some evidence, deontological argument, cosmological argument. Now, the second cosmological argument, I'm putting something on the table. You might try to refute it. Maybe you can, but I'm putting something, but you need to show me that you can, because I'm putting something on the table. I'm just, you know, it's always easy to try to poke a hole in something and not put anything on the table. I'm putting something on the table here, where we've got five arguments we're going to give that we can say, hey, this is evidence. Notice I said evidence. I didn't say this is an indubitable proof. It's evidence. So let's look at it. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. That seems to make both philosophic and scientific sense. Something can't come from nothing, right? Out of nothing, nothing comes. I want you to remember that. Out of nothing, nothing comes. The absence of anything, nothing can come. And if something can come from nothing, why only universes? Why only whole universes? I mean, why don't I see, you know, chickens appearing here, popping into existence? Because this is the quantum vacuum model. The quantum model basically says things pop into out of existence, out of nothing. But it's not out of nothing. It's out of an energy-rich field. You at least have to have the energy-rich field. I mean, when we say nothing in philosophy, we mean nothing, absolutely nothing. And our common experience, I think, and scientific evidence confirm the first one. I think that's intuitively true. But what about the second premise? Did the universe begin to exist? Well, if the universe never began to exist, then the number of past events is infinite. Now, I want you to kind of get a sense of what that means. That would be like trying to count up from the lowest negative number. It's like trying to jump out of a bottomless pit. If the universe is infinite, meaning it had no beginning or end, we'd never get to this point. If I say to you, Caleb, can you go get me a gallon of milk down at the store? It's only an infinity down the way. How long would it take him to get there? He wouldn't. It's infinitely far. So to say that the universe is infinite, for example, just doesn't seem to make sense. If it's always existed, then it's infinite. And we have an argument against that. There was a guy named David Hilbert. He was considered maybe the best mathematician, German mathematician of the 20th century. And he had this thing called Hilbert's Hotel, where he said that imagine yourself having a hotel, and he says that there are an infinite number of rooms, and they're all filled by guests. And he says, lo and behold, somebody comes up to your hotel and says, hey, I need a room. Well, you say, well, no problem. I'll just shift the person from room one to room two. Come on in. And then he says, well, now imagine an infinite number of people showing up at the hotel. He says, they said, we need rooms. And he said, no problem. He says, what I'll do, he says, I'm going to shift everybody, we'll multiply the room number by two. So one will go to two will go to four, and three will go to six, and four will go to eight. Anytime you multiply a number by two, it always comes out even. Basically, he's shifting them all to even numbers, rooms. Now he's got an infinite number of odd rooms. Come on in. What you find is that infinity is nice in the abstraction, but it doesn't actually exist. And when you look at this lemniscate, that eight that you see turned on its side, that's actually not an actual infinite. That's usually denoted by an aleph. This just means indefinite. It's moving toward infinity, but it doesn't reach it. So you can't have an infinite series of events before here. And by the way, what about that?
I don't get that. I don't buy that argument.
Okay.
Because it's let's look.
The
argument is that you can't have an infinite number of events because then we wouldn't be here and now.
Right.
But you don't have to have people or beings to have time. Time can.
But we do exist.
But you can have a possible world with its only time, nothing else.
Well, I don't think so, because space and time are related. You'd have to have space. I mean, let's suppose there was, but here's the thing. That doesn't help us for explaining the existence of the universe, is which we're arguing. Maybe a possible world with just time and no matter. But we're saying, based on the evidence that we have, what's the best possible? See?
Yeah.
So, if the past number of events were infinite, it'd be like counting up back from the, trying to get to zero from the whatever the largest or smallest, depending how you look at it, negative number is. How do you get there?
But God is infinite. He
always existed. So what does that mean? That there couldn't be, that he had to be timeless.
Outside finiteness.
He has to be timeless, because we're talking about time, the beginning.
Okay.
So we're getting there. You're tracking. So, by the way, the second law of thermodynamics, does anybody know what that is? Things tend toward decay, right? What's that?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
The idea is this. There's a finite amount of energy in the universe. It's like having a battery. Let's suppose the universe is run by a battery. If it had been running forever, by the time we got here, there would be no usable energy. The second law of thermodynamics. Now, that's a scientific thing that is beyond theory. We take it as fact. You know, it's certainly not a hypothesis. It's beyond theory. It's a law. You go from hypothesis to theory to law. This is made law. So, if the universe had existed, and by the way, let me stand up because you may need it. So here are the arguments. Number one, you can't have an actual infinite. Number one. Number two is the second law of thermodynamics precludes us, the universe, being going on forever because it'd run out of energy by now. We wouldn't have any energy. The sun wouldn't even be a star anymore. It would have run out of usable energy. And then the third one is this thing called the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem. Now, these are mathematicians. It's abbreviated BGV. Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem. So there's like these three guys, and none of them are believers. They actually developed a mathematical proof that if it says any universe that has on average been expanding throughout its history, this is exactly the standard model of the Big Bang. This is the one we have empirical evidence for. All these others are just kind of hypotheses, but we actually have reason to believe in that our universe is expanding. It says that any universe that has on average been expanding throughout its past cannot be infinite in the past or eternal in the past. It has to have a finite space-time boundary. What that means in common language is there is a point at which the universe did not exist. It couldn't have been forever. The Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, held by atheists, says that, or agnostics really, some atheists, says no way. Here's a mathematical proof. So they give a proof. They said you can't hide behind that anymore. And by the way, if anybody needs to go, I understand. But now what does that mean? Well, that means that the universe began to exist. Why is that important? Well, let's see here. Here's why it's important. Think about this. Space, time, and matter come into being at a certain point. Now, that means whatever brings space, time, and matter into being has to be what? Timeless, spaceless, and immaterial. Right? When did the space, time, and matter come into being? At the Big Bang. Boom. Space, time, and matter. There was what you might call the initial singularity, and then it comes into being. But that means whatever brought it into being, everything that begins to exist has a cause. So what's the cause? Whatever the cause is, it can't be space, time, or matter, because they don't exist until after the Big Bang. Space, time, and matter don't come into being until after the Big Bang. So whatever the cause of the universe is has to be timeless, spaceless, and immaterial. Well, I can only think of two things that fit that description: abstract objects like numbers or minds. And we've got good evidence that for the immateriality of the mind. We'll go into that later. But the idea is this, that the number 8 doesn't cause anything. 8 doesn't move a paper or flip a switch or do anything. It's an abstract object, but that only leaves minds. But if that's the case, you've got a timeless, spaceless, immaterial mind. And to bring the whole universe into existence, it would have to be unimaginably powerful. And by the way, it can't be caused by anything else. It has to be uncaused. And I'd argue necessary. Well, you may not want to put the label God on there, but that sounds a whole lot like God. And by the way, if the universe was brought into being, that means there had to be a mind for volition. To bring something, if it hasn't always existed, to bring it into existence, space-time and matter into existence would require a choice to do that. It could, otherwise you have to argue that the universe has existed forever, but we've got good evidence to the contrary. The evidence is stacked against it. Now again, am I saying this proves God exists? No, I'm saying our best scientific evidence demonstrates, if the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem holds true, and that theorem is a mathematical proof, then if the universe that we're observing is the actual universe, and, or even if it's a multiverse, it applies. There was a point at which the universe did not exist. So there was no space, time, and matter. If there's no space, time, and matter, then whatever brings it into being has to be timeless, spaceless, and immaterial. Does that make sense? Questions, comments, or concerns on that? I'm going to fly because we're out of time. I probably should have held off till this, from the first argument to this one. So here's the thing. The universe has a cause. That's the only thing we're arguing. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Why do we know it began to exist? Our best scientific observation. It seems to me if it had been around forever, it would run out of energy. It seems to me that that you can't count up from an, you know, you can't jump out of a bottomless pit. You have nothing to stand on. And there was no space, time, and matter until after the Big Bang. I'm assuming the Big Bang is true, by the way. But if that's the case, then the Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem applies to it. So whatever brought the universe into being, the cause has to be uncaused, right? You have to have a bookend. It must transcend space and time because there was no space and time. It must be immaterial. It must be unchanging. It must be powerful. It must be personal. Personal is because of volition, the reason why we argue that. Now, I'd like to very quickly, any questions, comments, or concerns on this? Because I rushed through it. Go ahead.
Just a quick thing. The Big Bang theory doesn't make any sense at all because who created the two things that went bang?
Well, here's the thing. I'm assuming Big Bang is correct. But if Big Bang is correct, it's exactly your point. Something had to bring it into being. I'm just assuming that the universe is something like 13.9 billion years old. I'm happy to concede that to the unbeliever or the skeptic or whatever. No problem with that. 13.9 billion years old. Not a problem. But when you go back, according to Bohr-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, it can't be back forever. Actually, it's relatively young in the light of eternity or an infinite number. I mean, something brought space, time, and matter into being, and it couldn't have been space, time, and matter because it didn't exist. Notice I didn't say before. I said there's a point at which the universe didn't exist.
It's very hard to use past tense.
Well, we can't. That's why I won't use it. I'll say there was a point at which the universe did not exist. There's a point at which there was no space, time, and matter. I didn't say there was a time when there was no space, time, and matter. I said there's a point. I'm careful with the words, and the reason is that if you believe that everything that begins to exist has a cause, and I think we've got good reason, the universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause, this one makes sense because our best science tells us this, philosophy is telling us this, and our intuitions seem to tell us this. Questions? Yeah.
Well, thank the universe for that. That's her explanation, that the universe is the reason why there's all these good things happening. How do you, like, what would be...
Well, then I would say don't thank anything because there's nothing praiseworthy if the universe did it, unless the universe is a person. What I mean is that unless it chose to do it, but then you're assigning personal attributes, yeah. Right? There's nothing praiseworthy about things just happening. You know, like dominoes falling. There's nothing praiseworthy. Why thank the universe? The universe can't think to do anything. It's not like the universe had intentions. The universe intended to bless me. How? Unless it's a mind. You know. And then if it chose to bless me, well then thank you. But it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense that a collection of contingent matter, ostensibly unthinking, is going to think to bless me. So, does that make sense? Yeah.
Okay, so I don't know how to say this, but I think we all have a feeling that something connects all of us,
non-believers give the universe as the explanation of that because we're all part of the universe. But the equivalent to Christians, I think, is the Holy Spirit, because we're all like God's breath, you know what I'm saying? Like, created by Him and the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, I think what Apace is saying is this: sometimes people will vacate what universe usually means, a collection of physical properties, and assign to it something, they give a new meaning to it. You know, I believe it's the Holy Spirit. But let's pray, and then anybody who wants to stay and ask questions, we'll go forward. Father, I want to thank you for your people, Lord. I pray that what was said tonight would be profitable, God, that it would sink down, that it would cause people to think. Lord, if there was confusion, clear it up. God, if I was unclear, help me to be clearer next time. God, I pray blessings on each one of your people. I pray that they go forth in your power. Lord, that you would use them defend your glory, and Lord, to declare it to people. Lord, that they would win unbelievers, they themselves would be strengthened in their beliefs, and that they would shape culture. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, if anybody has questions about this argument, what happened was, as I spent too much time on the first one, I think we could have spent a little more time on that second one, because I think it answers the questions. And in the future, I might do that. I mean, like, I might be like, hold on, because we're getting there. Because usually, if you're good thinkers like you, you're going to anticipate what's coming, and that's good. Yeah. Annette is
I really don't anticipate. It's like, I don't know what you're going for.
Well, I know that's why it's you're anticipating. What I mean is you're anticipating problems that are going to be answered later. Yeah.
I think you also have to do like a 5-minute crash course on general relativity and bring in the
Really.
Yeah. So. How many have that book, On Guard? On Guard goes into some details on that. Yeah. Well, clear as mud, no. You find it confusing?
No, it's
confusing.
The one that I can get over is that, like, the abstract thing. Like, the abstract thing is created by its identity of the number, triangle, and the identity of human that up with fear.
Yeah.
No class next week.
Oh yeah. By the way, if you have the syllabus, you'll notice no class next week. It's Lent. Lent service.
Yeah.